From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the dollars and cents of fixing Detroit's crumbling schools.
By 2023, if we don't make significant investments, that $500 million number will rapidly increase to $1.3 billion.
Michigan librarians becoming first responders in the opioid crisis.
One day, someone came running up to the desk and said, "There's someone sick in the restroom." So she grabbed her cell phone and ran in there, and sure enough, there was this woman lying on the floor with a needle in her arm.
Two brothers head to L.A. from rural Michigan, and that inspires their new kids' cartoon show on Disney.
And moving out here was a bit of a culture shock coming from our, like, dirt roads and cornfields.
Yeah, you can take the boy out of Clinton County, but you can't take the Clinton County out of the boy, you know?
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Years of neglect, years of austerity have taken a terrible toll on school buildings in the Detroit Public School Community District. They've completed a review of facilities, and the result is stunning. The cost to fix Detroit school buildings is a staggering $500 million. With us now, DPSCD Superintendent Dr. Nikolai Vitti. So here's the report with the price tag to fix Detroit schools. Did this surprise you?
Not surprised. You know, when I first started to interview for the position and I visited schools, I was asked what was most shocking or what I was most surprised by in the beginning phases of engaging the district. And what I had indicated was the condition of the facilities. Obviously, I've been in large urban school districts throughout the country. And in walking some of the buildings, it was shocking how those buildings had deteriorated over the years and the proper investments weren't made in just basic upkeep. So the dollar amount, frankly, was not shocking. Now that we've defined the problem, we have to start talking about it, informing stakeholders about it inside the district, outside the district, in Detroit, outside of Detroit, because if you don't define the problem, you never can move to a solution. And for those that have been working in the district for years, they've known that these conditions existed, but frankly, emergency managers didn't talk about it, didn't own it. Previous governance structures at Lansing level didn't talk about it, didn't own it. And this is just going to accumulate and challenge over the years. In fact, by 2023, if we don't make significant investments, that $500 million number will rapidly increase to $1.3 billion. So this problem isn't getting any easier. Each year it's going to become more difficult and more severe.
Before we talk money and dollars, take us back into those buildings as you walked through them and give everyone a sense of the kind of conditions you saw that are being reflected in this $500 million estimate.
Everything from windows not being able to open and close, ceiling tiles that are water stained, as you walk the hallways, tile on the floor that's warped with holes in them, classroom doors that don't open and close, holes in walls. Those were all things that I saw when I first visited schools, and I haven't even talked about proper investment in technology infrastructure, for example. That I would consider necessity in today's facility expectations, but in many ways that would be a luxury considered what I'm speaking about. And then to go farther, as far as what I saw throughout the course of the year, is roofs that were not properly maintained. So classrooms had to be closed because of leaking roofs, increase in moisture and mildew because of the moisture. And so those would be other examples of what I've seen and saw throughout the year.
Tough to sell the merits of a district when you see such crumbling buildings and infrastructure.
Well, I think it has to be a differentiated conversation. On the one hand, we do have buildings that have been upgraded or that are newer, so new facilities. So I think you have to look at every individual schools and have a conversation about every individual school. You also have to have a conversation about what can happen in a building even when you have inferior infrastructure. There still can be good teaching and learning happening in the building. You can still engage children authentically and build relationships with them and families. So good things can still happen in a building that is not properly upgraded and maintained. But then again, you also know that children realize the conditions that they're seeing. Parents see that. Parents and students know that children in Detroit have been treated in many times as second-class citizens, and they see it. They can drive down 94, they can drive down other roads in Detroit moving in the suburbs and see that there is a stark difference between schools. And you go beyond Metro Detroit and you see brand new buildings that almost look like community colleges or universities, and these are public schools. So you can see the discrepancy even the farther away you go from Metro Detroit.
When the state came up with the plan to bail out Detroit schools, it allocated about $25 million for building improvements. So now you have this report, and you're looking at this gap. What now?
What we need to do is own the repairs that we have a budget to address. We've identified a number of schools that have inadequate roofs, and we are making the investment over the summer into the fall into those buildings. I think that's something we can do immediately. So we are using the dollars that we have to address significant and immediate safety to life issues, and making investments in areas where, again, we can see the greatest return on investment for, like I said, a new roof. But we are going to have to use this review to have a broader conversation with the legislature, hopefully with the new governor, about what we do differently in Detroit. And frankly, the problems that we've articulated in Detroit are most extreme. But these problems exist in rural districts in Michigan and other urban type of districts throughout Michigan. So yes, the problem in Detroit is more profound and broader at scale. But when I talk to superintendents throughout Michigan and you hear the conversation, there are issues of infrastructure concerns in Michigan and really throughout this country that have been neglected. And as you well know, your organization is only as strong as its infrastructure because it allows for a sustainable long-term approach to the services that you're providing. But, I mean, we've heard times and times again, not only schools, but roads, bridges, dams have not been properly invested in. And we have underfunded many projects and initiatives throughout this country. And then that's most seen every day in schools, but you see them even when you drive the road. So there is a point to be made that funding infrastructure provides long-term investment in many different areas. And it's time to have that conversation about schools, but even broader than schools.
Well, Dr. Vitti, you talk about talking with other superintendents and other districts who face their own problems with infrastructure. But unlike them, am I correct? The Detroit district, you can't borrow money for construction projects the way other districts can.
That's right. And our local property taxes or revenue that's generated is paying the legacy debt. And that will not be paid, if all things stay the same, until anywhere between 2040 and 2050. So what other districts can use to start to at least fill the gaps, we cannot. We also can't borrow. And so we are even at a stronger disadvantage than other districts. Now, we are exploring the opportunity to use maybe a sinking fund in the future, but that's also limited as far as what revenue can be generated in that area. Obviously, we need a broader conversation with Lansing in the next few years. We'll expend the dollars that we have, but this problem is not going away. And if we're truly committed as a state to offer strong traditional public education in Detroit, and we're serious about local control having a fair chance to repair the mistakes of emergency management, then you have to have a real conversation about infrastructure and funding. And this is what this study allowed us to now have a conversation about, because it's third-party based, it's not politically driven, it's from experts that were not tied to the district. And so now we have the data, and now we can have the conversation.
Do you see layoffs as an option?
Absolutely not. You know, we are already underfunded when you look at the way in which funding is allocated in Michigan. You know, when you think about giving everyone the same, you can talk about equality, but that's not a conversation about equity. You know, there has been a recent study performed about how finances should change as far as school funding in Michigan, and that conversation is about differentiated funding or a weighted student formula based on the children that you serve, whether they're English language learners, they have special needs, or even if you're facing poverty. And so when you give districts the same amount of dollars, if you give a child an allocated amount in Birmingham and it's the same amount as Detroit, then you can argue that it's equal, but it's not equitable. And if we truly want to give children equal opportunity, then you have to have differentiated or equitable funding, not necessarily equal funding. That's a different conversation that we need to have in a broader conversation. But in the end, no, layoffs aren't an option because we are already stretching our dollars as much as possible to try to address the issues that poverty brings. And if we cut personnel, then we're going to do an even more of a disservice to children.
In the final moments we have you, Dr. Vitti, since we've got you here, this is the one-year anniversary of you becoming the superintendent of the Detroit Public Schools Community District. What's been your biggest takeaway from this first year?
The biggest takeaway is that this can be done. We can rebuild the district. We just need time, support, and space. And that support has to come through resources, but support also comes with protecting local control and giving us the flexibility to make the decisions that we need to make in order to rebuild the district. But after a year's work, I do believe that this can happen. It just needs to happen with the time, resources, and space to do it. It's not going to happen overnight. You can't deteriorate and frankly destroy a district over a decade of mismanagement and expect it to turn around in a year. But after being in the district for a year, I believe that people want change. I think people have been supportive of best practice type of change. They've been open-minded with the reform that's already been initiated. Most of the initiatives have been well supported. But we, again, people have to have a degree of patience and a willingness to give the district the time to create more credibility to transform the district and not work around the district as we try to rebuild it. But I was optimistic coming in, but I remain optimistic because I know it can be done. We just need to be given the time, resources, and space to do it.
Detroit School Superintendent Dr. Nicolae Vitti, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new Disney cartoon draws on the co-creator's rural Michigan upbringing.
Yeah, and we really tried to take a lot of that adventure and exploration and curiosity that we had as kids and put that into the show.
And then in 10 minutes, the secret not life of native bees. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Disney Channel just rolled out a new animated kids cartoon series called Big City Greens.
Meet Cricket Green.
Hi there.
He and his family are moving from the country into the big city.
Wow.
I know a lot about the city. In fact, I know a secret way people in the city get around. Nope, never mind.
Big City Greens comes from co-creators and brothers Chris and Shane Houghton, who grew up in Clinton County in the small Michigan town of St. John's. And they're with us now via Skype. Chris and Shane Houghton, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hello.
So good to have you with us. Hey, Chris, you have to be feeling pretty pleased. Disney just rolls out your show and renews it for a second season. Boom.
Yeah. Oh, it's been incredible. Shane and I have been working on this show together for years now. Animation's a very slow process. And we've been working with a huge group of talented artists and writers. And to finally have it come out and you know, share it with the world, it's absolutely amazing.
Shane, give us the elevator pitch for Big City Greens and tell us a little about the Greens.
Sure. So the Big City Greens is about a country family that moves from the rural countryside to a big city, aptly named Big City. We follow Cricket Green, who is a kind of mischievous little boy whose curiosity drives him to explore his new surroundings, along with his sister Tilly, who's kind of a unique, kind of weird girl based on a bunch of like 4-H girls that Chris and I knew growing up. They're traveling with their dad, Bill, who is a single father and farmer who's a bit overwhelmed by his whole new situation. And they're moving in with Grandma Alice, who is kind of a sweet and sour old grandma who is based on our actual Grandma Alice.
Oh, and you've even used Grandma's name. I love that to pieces. So clearly you have layered in a lot of your small town Michigan upbringing into this show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We have almost every main character is based on somebody we knew growing up, whether that was a family member, neighbor, relative. We really like to pull in the people from our community and kind of wrap them up into the show and drop them into, you know, they were all people we knew growing up in the country, drop them into this new, like, big city environment that we're currently now living in. We both live in Los Angeles. And moving out here was a bit of a culture shock coming from our, like, dirt roads and cornfields.
Yeah, you can take the boy out of Clinton County, but you can't take the Clinton County out of the boy, you know?
Yeah, Chris, I know that you are the spirit and the voice of Cricket, so let me talk to Cricket a little bit.
Yeah, let me, hey, get over here, Cricket. What do you want? I'm on the radio, come here. All right, I'm on the radio right now? Yes.
Yes, you are, Cricket. So how do you like being a TV star, Cricket?
Well, you know, I've always known I was destined for greatness. You know, getting my mug in front of a camera or a voice on the radio, it's just, you know, I think the people will agree. It's just right.
Well, just stop and think about it. You're on the Disney Channel. You are following in the footprints, if we will, or the paw prints of Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, I never heard of him.
Well, I'm interested. Would people who went to school with you guys say, oh, yes, I could see Chris and Shane heading to L.A. and landing a TV deal with Disney? Or do you think this comes as a surprise to friends you grew up with in Michigan?
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of like the idea of it being a complete surprise. like they didn't even know, I think strangely enough, it's not a surprise. I think, you know, we were really open about how much we love to draw and tell stories. And we were always doing tons of, plays in the drama club at St. John's High. So, we've actually been getting a lot of messages from folks back home and even, you know, friends we haven't seen in years saying, like, I knew it. You know, watching your show right now. It's so cool to see it all come around full circle.
What do you most remember when you think of growing up in St. John's? For each of you, what are the memories that really stick in your mind that actually fuel material for your show?
Well, we lived out kind of in the countryside where our nearest neighbor was like a half mile down the road.
Yeah, so, we didn't live in town. That was the big thing.
We were very jealous of the kids who could like walk down the street to a gas station and buy a candy bar whenever they wanted.
Yeah, that's a life.
we were out there and I think we grew up, there was three boys, three Houghton brothers. And I think our mom, whenever she got sick of us, she would just kick us outside and say, go play outside. And so we would spend our summers kind of just running around their property. And we had a pond that we swam in. There was a forest behind the field behind our house. There was a creek. And so we would just go outside and we would mess around with our animals. And we had farm animals for a little while and build forts and just have a really fun time just kind of by ourselves in the wilderness. And it was just a very freeing, fun time.
Yeah, and we really tried to take a lot of that adventure and exploration and curiosity that we had as kids and put that into the show. You know, even when we were finding Kit and Tilly's bedroom that they share together, we just ended up putting a lot of things from outside in their bedroom because we figured that's just where they kind of store their treasures. They spend all their time outdoors.
You know, when you describe this growing up and so much time outdoors and now, you know, from your where you couldn't even walk down the street to buy a candy bar. And here you are in L.A. Talk about fish out of water. And you put so much of that humor in Big City Greens. So what are some of the more jarring changes for the Greens in moving to Big City? I mean, I'm interested in which of these came from your personal experiences as you adjusted to L.A.
Oh, yeah. Well, every episode we try to pull something truthful from our lives. One of the writers, we try to put something in that it starts with a nugget of like, oh yeah, this happened to me one time. But then of course we kind of inflate it and make it a little bit more adventurous and big to fit our characters. But yeah, every episode there's usually a little something that, you know, Cricket wants to achieve, something that he's trying to, you know, whether it's his status with his neighbors, you know, he decides he's going to launch a chicken into space. That'll make a good first impression on his neighbors. if he does something really big. We have an episode where, this is from our life, our dad wanted to take a family photo of us. And so he took us to this place when Chris and I were both in middle school, which, as everybody knows, is your most awkward time in life. And you just, you don't look quite right. And we
perfect time for a photo.
And he ordered a huge, like, poster-sized print of this very awkward photo, and it hung up in our house for years and years and years. And so we based an episode on that that's playing a little later this summer.
I love it. You know, there are kids listening to you talk and watching your story who are where you were a few years ago. There you were drawing, you were in the theater, and you've made it, you've made a big step forward in your career. Anybody that lands a deal and gets their show after all these years on Disney, and as we said, not only has it just been rolled out, they've already renewed it for a second season. Talk to those at the beginning of the journey who have those dreams. What do you do to make it happen?
Right. Yeah. Well, first of all, listener, it's tricky. You know, I feel like the reason Shane and I are where we are is due to a lot of reasons. But one of them is we were lucky enough to have great mentors and teachers throughout the years, as far back as, you know, like even I think about elementary school, middle school, especially high school, with drama teachers, high school art teachers that really helped shape our interests and passion. So to any young folks listening, to really try to find your passion, whatever it is, and it's really just never too early to go after it. And I would say any young person that can start to cultivate that, that will propel them to wherever they want to go.
The advice I always tell people who want to get to this position is to just make stuff. Keep making stuff, and you'll learn from every project that you complete. There's so much value in finishing something. Even if halfway through you go, oh no, this is terrible, finish it and have a finished product, and you will learn just so much more from that. Chris and I started very early of just like making our own comic books in like elementary school. And then we made short films. We were in theater in high school. We were in bands together. And just after college, we made our comic book Reed Gunther, which is a self-published comic book. And then eventually we were picked up by a publisher. And everything kind of just kept rolling and building on the previous projects that we had made. So if people just keep making stuff, don't wait until somebody gives you the opportunity to make something. Just make it yourself.
Well, congrats on getting the show launched and on the second season. Chris and Shane Houghton, the brothers and co-creators of the new Disney Channel cartoon, Big City Greens, drawing on growing up in the small Clinton County town of St. John's. Guys, thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside. It was really a blast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Much of the attention on the problem of shrinking bee populations focuses on honeybees. But here's this. Michigan is home to hundreds of native bee species, and they play an equally important role as pollinators. Bees are hard workers. My next guest tells us one in every three bites of food we eat is made possible by bees. Think about that. Kelsey Graham is a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Entomology at Michigan State University, where she's a pollinator conservation specialist. Kelsey, good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks.
That is pretty stunning when you think that statistic you cite, one in every three bites of food we eat, we can thank bees for that. Why is that?
Yeah, so if you think about it, pretty much every like fruit and vegetable that we eat that has a flower needs to be pollinated by a bee. So think about blueberries, tomatoes, pretty much anything you have in your garden that has a flower is visited by a bee. And in order to produce a fruit, you need that transfer of pollen between flowers. So you need a bee to do that. And yeah, they're really well designed for it. That's why a lot of bees are really furry. It picks up the pollen and moves them between flowers.
And they also pollinate, what, alfalfa, which farm animals eat. So they're supporting the meat component of our diet as well.
Exactly. Yep.
Well, we've heard certainly a lot of talk in recent years about the decline in the honeybee population. That's been all over the news. Why do you think we haven't heard more about native bees?
Yeah, so for honeybees, they're definitely sort of the most important part of our agricultural system just because we do manage them specifically for pollination services. So they're heavily managed. They're not native to North America, but we use them throughout the agricultural system here. So they're brought into fields specifically for these pollination services, and we really depend heavily on them for intensified agriculture. However, wild bees also play a role, but we don't manage them specifically for that role. So they're kind of like along the side of fields and definitely enter and help out with the pollination services that honeybees also provide.
All right. And as I read your piece in the conversation, I couldn't believe when I see that there are some 5,000 native bee species in North America, and we have about 465 of them documented here in Michigan.
That's
wow.
Right. Yep. Yeah, it's a lot of bees. Yeah.
Well, tell us a little about the native bees that we have in our state. I mean, what are they like and where do we find them?
Sure. So we have 465, so a large number, and they're really diverse. So we've got little tiny bees that are about, you know, the size of a grain of rice or even smaller. And then we've got sort of the big bees like bumblebees and carpenter bees that people probably notice a lot more. Those are those big fuzzy bees you see in your garden. So those are really noticeable. And then often these tiny bees go completely unnoticed by people. So I always encourage you to kind of check out a flower in your garden, watch it for a little while, and you might see a tiny little bee visit, which is always fun.
So how are Michigan's native bees doing? How healthy are they?
So that's a big kind of question mark at this point, and that's really the focus of our current research is trying to better understand how the wild bees are doing just because there's so much of an unknown there. We know kind of a decent amount about the bumblebees. These are kind of a charismatic species that everyone seems to like. So they've got a lot of attention from the research world. And certainly there are definitely a lot of concerns there. But for the rest of the bees, we really know so little about them. We only have about 19 bumblebees in Michigan. And so the rest of them, we kind of know very little about. So right now we're kind of going around the state and collecting all the wild bees that we can find and then comparing them back to historic populations. So looking through museum specimens to see kind of which bees we had 50 years ago and which ones we can't find today. So that'll kind of pinpoint which ones we need to be concerned about in terms of a population decline and also point out the ones that are doing completely fine.
Tell us, why is it that these wild bees, these native bees, are such efficient pollinators? What are they doing differently than honeybees?
Yeah, so one thing that wild bees can do that honeybees can't is this thing called buzz pollination. So this is where a bee will kind of grab onto a flower and shake it really fast, and this expels the pollen. So the pollen will kind of shoot out of the flower, land on the bee, and this is really good for releasing that pollen and getting it onto another flower. So this is something wild bees do that honeybees can't, and it makes them really good pollinators, and is particularly good for things like blueberry that really need this kind of shaking action to release the pollen.
So they are good, hard little workers.
yeah, definitely.
And there is some concern about, as you write in your piece in the conversation, bumblebees are, some of them are in distress. What is driving the decline in their numbers?
Yeah, so as with most bees, it's kind of a combination of factors, most likely. Certainly, reduction in habitat is probably the one that we are the most focused on right now. Bees need flowers, and a lot of the kind of traditional areas where they would go and find a lot of food, like prairie areas, are being converted into row crops, so corn and soybean. So that's a loss of food for our wild bees, but also nesting habitat. So the majority of our native bees nest in the ground. And so if this is, you know, tilled or turned into a parking lot, that's an area that a bee can no longer make a nest in.
If someone wanted to support native bees, what can we do? Certainly, if you want to have honeybees in your yard, you invest in a hive, you buy some bees. But what do we do to support our native bees?
Yeah, so again, going back to the flower thing, bees need flowers. So if you can kind of put in flowers in your yard, or even, you know, if you live in an urban area, if you can just put out, you know, some pots with flowers, that's going to make a big difference for bees. There's a lot of lists online. I recommend people going to the MSU site. So that's pollinators.msu.edu. We'll have plant lists up there, as well as additional things that you can do, such as, you know, decreasing pesticide exposure. So, you know, you don't have to always spray your yards to get rid of all the bugs. It's, you know, bugs are good. So, you know, if you can limit your pesticide use, that's great. And certainly for farmers, that's something we work with them as well to do.
Kelsey, what drew you to entomology and particularly to diving into our bee population? What do you like about it?
So bees are super diverse and they all have kind of unique behaviors and life history traits. I'm classically more of an animal behaviorist and I just got really attached to kind of all these unique behaviors that bees have. So it's a great system to work in, and definitely in terms of applicability now for conservation, it's a really important area, I think, to be in.
And do bees get a bad rap because of wasps?
They certainly do. And of course, you know, we need wasps too. They play a valuable role in our ecosystem, but they definitely give bees a bad name. Most of the time when people talk about being stung, it's usually from a wasp. Really only the bees that we think about in terms of stinging people most often are bumblebees and honeybees. So the rest of them, you know, the 400, you know, so species probably won't sting you. So, yeah.
And they're busy helping us increase the output of our gardens.
Exactly. If you see a bee on a flower, it's busy. It's not going to bother you. So definitely I encourage people to go watch it for a little bit, see what it's doing. It's totally safe.
Kelsey Graham, pollinator conservation specialist and a postdoc research associate at Michigan State University. Kelsey, thank you for sharing your love of bees with us.
Thank you.
After the break, a Michigan nonprofit redesigning Amish farm equipment for African communities, plus how our libraries are training staff to respond to the opioid crisis. That's in 10 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When it comes to solving 21st century problems, problems such as food insecurity in developing countries, everything old is new again. That's the message of Tillers International. It's based in Scotts in Kalamazoo County. This nonprofit takes 18th century agricultural technology, including hardworking oxen, and then it works with engineers in the Amish to redesign the technology, plows and tools for African farmers. Jonathan Klein is executive director of Tillers International. I spoke with him earlier today via Skype and asked him why this 18th century technology is so valuable.
Well, the easiest answer is that it still works, and it works really, really well, and there's very little that can go wrong on a lot of these parts. So as far as the sustainability, it works really, really well in these villages where the disposable income isn't there to go out and spend $1,000 on parts when something breaks. And then with the oxen as well, it's much more readily available to find a team of young cattle that can be trained as oxen rather than relying on imports.
What are some of the projects that Tillers International has done?
Currently, we're working in Madagascar, Mozambique, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Burkina Faso. And most of that work is centered around using a draft animal power to pull a ground-driven agricultural equipment like we would have used here, as you said earlier, back in the 18th, 19th century. So a lot of that work is looking at plows and equipment that they have on the ground there, looking at what suggestions we may be able to make to make that equipment work a little bit more efficiently, and then working with local artisans there to construct all this equipment in country rather than importing things that may work fine for a month or two only to break and then start rusting out in the field because the parts can't be found. We work with local blacksmiths, woodworkers, and various metal workers to construct all of these tools in country. One that we've been working on a lot recently has been a planter so that people don't have to go and hand plant the fields. And then essentially we'll go over and we'll work with some farmers and they'll tell us what they like about it and what they hate about it. And then we go back to the drawing board and try to break it to make sure that we've kind of looked at everything that could go wrong with it and sit down with some local artisans to make sure that they know how to kind of troubleshoot these issues.
And Jonathan, are these largely Amish tools and equipment you're working with, or how are the Amish involved with this?
a lot of these tools that we work with in the fields, we also have a large farm where we do a lot of our test work. And a lot of the tools that we're working with in our field are from Amish equipment manufacturers. But a lot of the stuff that we're looking at in our museum that we're drawing our design inspirations from are just old 18th century tools that we kind of go from that base, and in collaborating with some of our Amish partners, looking at what we could do that could be easily replicated in Africa.
Give us a sense of the kind of improvement, the level of improvement you've been able to see.
Yeah, so we've seen where, you know, what would take somebody 2 or 3 days to plant by hand, that they're able to knock that out now in an afternoon, which is quite nice for people that are having to hunch over and plant by hand every day. One of the big outputs that we're focusing on right now in Burkina Faso, which isn't directly tied towards crop production output, but is looking at our gender components. And a lot of the agricultural work in Africa is done by women, and specifically young girls of school age. So what we've been seeing is when we introduce some of these tools into these communities that make it so that they don't need 10 people to plant by hand, that the communities are less likely to pull the young girls out of school, so that it's helping to keep a lot of these girls in the school system rather than being pulled out for manual labor.
Big ripple effects one might not think of.
Oh, yeah.
What has this work meant for you personally, Jonathan?
For me personally, I grew up in Africa. I first moved there when I was 5 years old, and probably about half my life overseas. So I think for me personally, it's just being able to connect with people who are, I mean, they're mothers and fathers just like all of us. And they're just looking for, you know, at the end of the day, a way to feed their kids, or to generate some income so that you can pay for a new roof or a new car or different things like this. And for me, I just like being a part of that. It's been such a big part of my life, and just to be able to connect with these communities and come alongside them.
We ought to let everybody know that the animal-powered farming world is having its equivalent to the North American International Auto Show, you might say, with the latest traditional technology on display, Horse Progress Days. And this year, it's being held in Michigan this Friday and Saturday, the 29th and 30th, in Clare. What will people see at Horse Progress Days?
There'll be lots of equipment demonstrations with agriculture, gardening. There'll be logging demonstrations. There's a pretty fun equipment fair where they have different teams of draft horses that'll pull new models that different groups have been working on. We'll be there with a booth, as well as walking in the equipment parade with a young team of oxen that were born on our farm, that our farmer in residence, Ivy's been training for the past 2 years. And Frank and Sparrow, who are those oxen, they'll be there pulling the planter that we've been working with Michigan State and Pioneer Equipment to introduce to our communities in Burkina Faso that we're currently working with.
So who comes in from where to Horse Progress Days?
It is a fairly large mix of Amish people, and that's one of the reasons that they rotate its location every year, because to travel the long distance isn't always realistic for the Amish community. So last year it was in Pennsylvania, the year before it was in Indiana, this year it's in Michigan. But then there's also a lot of people that are just into sustainable agriculture. They'll also have a lot of displays for alternative energy kind of stuff, alternative energy appliances, things like that. So you got a lot of people that are into kind of the back to the land or a farming kind of a movement that'll come to see, you know, what the newest in solar refrigeration looks like and things like that. So there's a pretty good mix of folks that are there. Just last week we had a group of, I don't know, they were like a couple people from New York State that were in their mid-20s that came down to buy a bunch of equipment from us. So it's not even just the Amish. There's a lot of small scale farmers in the organic farming movement that are using horses and whatnot. So it's kind of an interesting time.
So it'll be the 29th and 30th in Clare, Horse Progress Days. In the meantime, the work continues at Tillers International. And we want to thank Executive Director Jonathan Klein for sharing your work with us. Jonathan, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
The opioid epidemic touches every facet of life in our country, in our state. That includes libraries, where administrators and staff are figuring out the best response if a patron has an overdose or someone appears to be under the influence of drugs. Kevin King is with us now. Kevin is head of branch and circulation services at the Kalamazoo Public Library, and Gail Madziar is the executive director of the Michigan Library Association. Welcome to both of you, and Gail, I'd like to start with you. Tell us, how has the opioid crisis touched public libraries in Michigan?
Well, it's impossible to miss stories of overdoses happening in restrooms and parking lots of public libraries, especially in New York, Philadelphia, and Denver. And there, we know librarians have been administering the life-saving Narcan on a weekly and sometimes even a daily basis. And unfortunately, libraries across the country have become a common site for those overdoses, and that includes Michigan. Kevin can speak to what's happening in Kalamazoo, but also Grand Rapids, Muskegon. Those are among the libraries that have been sites of overdoses in recent years. And luckily, in those cases, law enforcement officers responded quickly enough to administer Narcan before it was too late. But these libraries now train staff and stock the Narcan kits, as many libraries across the state are now doing.
And certainly we should remind everybody, Narcan is a very, very important drug in keeping someone alive who is overdosed on opioids, because it kind of blocks the action of that molecule, of that opioid drug. So getting Narcan in a timely manner is very, very important. And Kevin, the Kalamazoo Public Library and its branches have developed a proactive approach to identifying and responding opioid use and overdoses. Tell us more about that.
Well, we decided, like you said, to take a proactive approach to the crisis, and we've done that in multiple ways. First, education, making sure our staff understands what it looks like when an individual, a patron, is maybe experiencing an overdose or under the influence of an opioid. And then two would be to make sure they are getting the training in applying the inhibitor, the Narcan, to somebody who might be overdosing. Third, we have decided to be proactive in the community. I work with the Kalamazoo County Opioid Coalition. It's an organization in the county looking at the crisis in Kalamazoo County and trying to determine ways in which the public library can be a player and an advocate and a resource for people in the county to combat and eradicate the crisis.
So how do you think, Kevin, things are different now that library staff has been kind of trained in best practices and that you've been so active with this? How are things different now?
Well, I want to touch upon one thing first. I think that the rise of opioid overdoses in libraries can be attributed to the fact that people who are taking opioids, if they are in a public place where there's a lot of people around and they do overdose, they know that somebody will find them, somebody will see them and possibly help to save their lives. In my research, that was what was being pointed to for the rise of taking these drugs in public places like the libraries. Your original question, how has the library responded to this and how has the staff responded to this? Well, they're better prepared because they have the information. They've gone through the training. We've just started to get a lot of our administrators and middle managers through the training. They recognize someone going through maybe heading towards an overdose. They see the signs. There's a lot of signs that you can recognize in an individual if they're beginning to pass out from an overdose. So having that information and being able to be aware of the situation around them has been extremely important. This is one of the things that we talk a lot about in the library and when it comes to customer service and what we call mental first aid. You know, how do we train our staff to provide the services of what people need when they come into the library? And one of those is making sure they're going to be safe when they're in our spaces.
Gail, give us an example of how important this is, something you've seen in a Michigan library.
Sure. Well, our president-elect, Kristen Shelley, was testifying at the Senate Health Policy Committee, and she told the story about how she worked in a library some years ago, and there was a regular patron that came in. She was a typical soccer mom. She had a 13-year-old and a 6-year-old, and they had been coming into the library for years. And one day, someone came running up to the desk and said, "There's someone sick in the restroom." So she grabbed her cell phone and ran in there. And sure enough, there was this woman lying on the floor with a needle in her arm. And she ultimately passed away because they weren't able to save her. And the whole point of this story is that it's not just, you know, drug addicts or street people who you might stereotypically think are going to be using drugs in a library. This woman was in a car accident. She had hurt her back and was in a lot of pain, and one thing led to another. So this is something that can affect just, you know, people that you and I know.
Kevin, you actually are relying on people that have experienced opioid use.
Yes, we're working with a local organization, the Recovery Institute of Southwest Michigan, to introduce a peer navigator program in Kalamazoo Public Library, which is bringing individuals into the library to help our staff identify patrons who are struggling with opioid addiction and to help steer them into the right services they need. And we're really proud of it. We're going to be the fourth library in the country with this sort of program, and we're hoping it will help be one way to help tackle the issue in our community.
Gail, as you think about this response of administering Narcan, that has raised in the past concerns about liability. And I know GOP State Senator Margaret O'Brien has introduced Senate Bill 829. Would you tell us about that bill and what it might mean to libraries in Michigan?
Sure, yes. And that's how Michigan Library Association got involved in this important project. And SB 828 and 829 both provide immunity for libraries in a situation that could arise from providing the life-saving treatment. Attorneys right now are often recommending that the libraries not stock the treatment because they could be held liable. These two bills would allow libraries and library employees to purchase, possess, distribute, and administer in good faith an opioid antagonist without possible subject to criminal prosecution. And it just provides immunity to libraries similar to that provided to public schools. And we testified in the Senate Health Policy Committee. And as we were doing that, the committee was so concerned and they were so responsive that the chair decided that he would like to hold up those bills and either amend them or rewrite them to include any area, any public area, bus stations, parks, that kind of thing, so that people can feel free to help provide this life-saving drug and not feel that they would be held liable. Now, there's always the Good Samaritan law that would provide liability protection for you or me. But when it comes to the actual entity, for instance, the library, they're a quasi-governmental agency, and they don't have the same immunities as, for instance, a school. So we wanted to make sure that libraries were included so that library attorneys didn't feel that the libraries were putting their assets on the line in trying to provide this.
So this I can tell from what you're saying, you feel this is an important tool in making libraries a safe, healthy space for everyone, and also giving library employees the protection to be able to, let's say, administer Narcan if needed.
Right. It provides them with protection from civil and criminal liability, and that makes sure that libraries are more able to easily access and administer to opioid overdoses in and around the library, whether that's in the library itself, in the parking lot, wherever it might be.
Kevin, Kalamazoo Public Library has really been, as we say, very, very proactive in responding to the opioid epidemic. What is your message to libraries around Michigan?
Well, my message is it's you need to look into it, no matter what size of the community. The opioid crisis happens in the smallest towns and in the largest cities in our state. So being proactive, seeking out ways, setting up systems, getting the training, finding partners in your communities to come up with a process and a procedure to work with individuals to get the Narcan in your libraries and to train people how to apply on the life-saving drug to make sure that you're keeping your people in your libraries safe and you are helping direct people, you know, beyond that into other services.
Speaking from the front lines of libraries' response to the opioid epidemic, Kevin King with the Kalamazoo Public Library and Gail Madziar, Executive Director of the MLA, the Michigan Library Association. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Sam Corey, Sarah Leeson, Lindsay Scullin, and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.